Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Media Voices. I'm your host, Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston, back after a couple of months away from the podcast. Some listeners might know my wife Alison passed away a couple of weeks before Christmas. I just wanted to say a huge thanks for all your messages of support. Thanks to everyone that's accommodated my flaky schedules over the past couple of months, especially my two wonderful co-hosts. And a massive thank you, I mean a massive thank you, to the good people of our National Health Service, from GPs to district nurses, specialist oncology teams to healthcare assistants, and especially staff at the hospice where Alison died. You're 100% amazing. Thank you so much for all that you did for us.
It's good to have you back.
Thank you. Chris, while I was away, I guess you had your own NHS experience.
Yeah, my appendix exploded, which is why we missed last week's episode.
God, at least it wasn't trapped gas.
That's true. I was so worried about that.
That would not have been good.
This week, I spoke to Simon Brew, the editor and founder of podcast turned magazine Film Stories. There's some really heartening lessons in there about leaping headfirst into an endeavor you believe in, finding a successful new route along the well-trodden road of film-based magazines, and about giving new voices a chance to be heard. Before that, though, as ever, the news. And Esther, you said that this first news story scared you a little bit, right?
It's because every time I think everything about Facebook, all the conspiracy theories about Facebook, every time I'm like, nah, they're just conspiracy theories, it's fine. They do something like this, and I'm like, okay, no, this is... I think this broke sort of quite like yesterday, but Facebook are planning to integrate Instagram, WhatsApp, and Facebook Messenger as kind of one big messaging service, so you can message somebody in WhatsApp from Facebook. And they're basically, to do that, they're merging all the backends to make sharing data and developing tools and apps for all three a much simpler process.
It also has the corollary benefit for Facebook of allowing businesses and brands to potentially send messages across as well. So there is definitely a monetary aspect to this.
2.6 billion users they were going to have on one messaging platform. Can you imagine the Catholic Church had that kind of control?
Yeah. Jeez. Well, do you think we're going to have to worship at the Temple of Zuckerberg one day?
Maybe, man. That's a lot of human beings.
The space pope. Yeah, it does make sense from the business perspective for Facebook. The BBC.
No, I disagree with this.
Okay, all right.
I don't think it does at all. So one of the things Facebook has done in the last year, if either of you use Messenger, is that they started monetizing Messenger. You go onto the app with all your friends listed and they've got like ads in there and stuff like that. And Facebook also use, and they've said this quite openly, they use the messages you send to each other in Messenger to target ads. And one of the things that they will have to do if they merge this all with WhatsApp is they will have to encrypt. Nobody would accept WhatsApp going backwards on encryption. Mm. And if they encrypt, they can't scrape that data to sell ads. So they suddenly lose out on a huge chunk of monetization there. So is it one of the things where they've looked and they've said, actually, the benefits of combining are more than the benefits of scraping that data for ads? I don't kind of really know what that's about.
There is the suggestion that this is effectively a good news story for Facebook, a managed good news story, because it is increased security across all three platforms. As I can't remember who said it on Facebook, you have a much smaller attack space than you do if you have all three messaging apps acting separately.
I think that headline number is the scary part of this. You know, the whole antitrust angle, if you like, that one business, actually one human being, Mark Zuckerberg, has that much influence over 2.6 billion people. You know, if Microsoft got taken apart for what it was doing with Internet Explorer, for numbers that don't even come close to that, yeah. I think there's an antitrust thing building in the background here. But, I don't know.
Something was filed on Thursday about that. I'm sure there was an antitrust situation that was filed with the American government about it.
I've got to be honest, this story melts my head. I can't quite get my head around this. You know, Chris, you wrote in our notes, what does this mean for publishers? And at first I wrote, sweet fuck all, because I can't actually see how publishers are. And then I walked that back, and actually it could be huge, because with social reach falling anyway and people ditching the Facebook app off their phones but keeping the Messenger app on their phones, you know, people turn into messaging rather than social, mm-hmm. then if Facebook can figure out a way to do what Esther's talking about, get ads targeted inside these apps without pissing everyone off, then it could be huge. But it means more chatbots, and it means more stuff that I quite frankly don't understand.
Well, I mean, the trend was to chatbots already. If you look at what was happening across Asia, you know, some of the bigger messaging apps over there are based heavily around chatbots. So it was always going to be something we'd see replicated in the West. Well,
and there's another thing that gives me the absolute jitters about this. There's been a huge move, you know, we've discussed this plenty of times about the delete Facebook. People have kind of tried to disassociate themselves with Facebook, and they've all moved to WhatsApp and Instagram, which is just funny. But anyway, one of the concerns, and I mean, The Guardian articulated this much better than I could, is that WhatsApp users who don't share much personal info at all with Facebook, or who don't have accounts or have deleted accounts, may suddenly find all that data kind of mingled back in. So it's like, right, okay, you may choose not to share your data with Facebook because of how the Facebook app works, but if WhatsApp Messenger sharing all that anyway, it takes away so much of that control over where and how you share your data.
Yeah, that might ultimately could just come down to execution, but you're right, that is a very scary proposition, considering, you know, that people already have concerns about how much data Facebook and its attendant products have.
It might come down to execution, because we trust Facebook so much to execute this stuff ethically. Yeah.
But if say a hypothetical, I'd completely come off Facebook, or I'd never been on it for whatever reason, I'd deleted everything, and somebody on Facebook wants to get in contact with me, if they're enabling that to get in contact with my WhatsApp, there's data going back the other way.
We need to talk about the name for this thing.
Oh, you're right.
So go on, Chris. What's your preferred name for it?
So I said that this was going to be called, where is it? What's Gramminger? Just because that seems to be the most logical combination of those names.
No, I've got a much better one than that.
Go on.
What is the up a mess? I think it could catch on. I'm hashtagging that.
Luckily, there are enough InfoSec journalists out there and enough technology journalists to keep us fully abreast of all this kind of stuff. And there's no way that we're ever going to lose any more journalism jobs. Am I right?
I think sometimes we get a little bit, I was going to say blasé, that's the wrong word, but we take this for granted. We get a little bit sort of, more job losses. But actually, this is brutal in the States. You know, it's 1,000 media jobs between BuzzFeed, Gannett, Verizon Media. The BuzzFeed one is pretty bad.
Yeah, the BuzzFeed one is
pretty heavy.
Particularly scary. I was kind of watching this all unfold on Twitter, and some of the people who were coming out and saying that they've been let go after, you know, 7-9 years at the company was ridiculous to watch. You know, people across the national security team, which you would have thought, you know, that's more vital now than ever, and a bunch of people from the lifestyle team, which just doesn't seem to make sense to me, considering what they did in their, you know, what they set out in their 9 boxes memo.
I don't know. I mean, is this because finally people are waking up to the reality of it, and it's not all about stupid venture capital fueled valuations, and we're actually getting to a stable, manageable, sustainable workforce? Or is it just these guys panicking and paying people off? I don't know.
You know, if you are going to have a sustainable model, it looks like it will be smaller digital publishers, and that does require that you don't require as many, you know, editorial staff members as you once did.
There's been a lot that's gone in BuzzFeed News as well, and I think given a lot of the work they've done over the last 2 years, I was just on Twitter, and it felt like almost every other tweet was another journalist having lost their job, and it was just. It's really sad.
It was
like, what's it, what do they call that? The worst day in January when your credit card bill arrives?
Oh, is that Blue Monday? Is that PR-inspired Blue Monday?
Yeah, it's a little bit like that for people's job. I mean, it's like you're talking about 200 people at BuzzFeed.
They've only actually laid off 50 out of the expected 250 so far. They're staggering the rest over next week.
Yeah, which is weird. I put this in the notes. Can either of you think of a reason why they would stagger layoffs like this? I think it was, you know, is it literally just a human resources thing that you know, they want to do it in a personal way and they don't necessarily have the resources to go and do it? Or is this just a sort of a case of trying to manage public reaction to it?
Maybe they don't know who they're going to cut yet and they're trying to figure it out.
But it seems to be, if they're choosing who to cut now, it's going to be right down to the wire.
Oh my word, imagine, you know, imagine if you're there and you've got a meeting booked for Tuesday and you've got to get through the entire weekend with that over your head.
Well, it's not only that, it's, you know, people were talking about survivor's guilt as well. You know, if you do, if you are one of the people who survives this round of cuts, you then have to deal with the guilt that, you know, a lot of your friends have been let go. It's an impossibly difficult situation for everybody. Esther, do you want to go through some of the other numbers though? Because it does put them in perspective.
Yeah, so Verizon is looking to cut 800 jobs. I mean, that's 7% of its global workforce. So that includes AOL, Yahoo, Huffington Post. I think a lot of the ones I've seen so far have been HuffPost. Mm. But that's after the CEO said that each of the company's three units, including the media business, needed to be able to stand on their own. So that sounds a little bit like, you know, was the media business being propped up by the other two? I don't know.
Wouldn't be unusual. Gannett has
cut 20 jobs. Yeah, and BuzzFeed is looking to lay off about 15%. You know, like I said, it's about 250 jobs over the next couple of weeks.
Is Gannett not up for some VC company buying it?
That was rumored last week. So they were looking to buy one company, and then the other company is looking to buy them. They're now looking to cut their costs with these buyout rumors.
Jesus.
Yeah, a brutal day. I think that one of the potential knock-on effects of this is Recode was talking about BuzzFeed having a potential merger with Group 9, which is another big digital publisher, but of the sort of content that we associate with BuzzFeed rather than BuzzFeed News. You know, that kind of easy to churn out, for lack of a better term, relatively low quality content that doesn't actually require much investment. And Jay Rosen on Twitter asked, can you see room for serious journalism at BuzzFeed after all this? You know, news is expensive to produce, and if they are looking to merge with Group 9, that kind of to me indicates that their priorities might not be around news for much longer.
Or they could just do that. They actually could finally spin out BuzzFeed News like they talked about.
Yeah.
Maybe just sell it to the New York Times group.
So our heart goes out to everybody who's been involved in any job cuts and those who've, you know, might potentially be feeling any survivor's guilt, and we hope everyone lands on their feet.
In other news this week, I didn't know what to make of this, but Condé Nast have said that they're putting all of their titles behind paywalls by the end of 2019. Now, we've all been paywall advocates at some point in the last couple of years, but all of the titles, is this really a good idea?
Yeah, as I said on Twitter, I do struggle to see how some of their titles will survive behind a paywall. This, to me, almost feels like it's a bit of a, sink or swim approach, seeing which brands they have that will survive behind paywalls, which does seem to be their strategy now.
Darwin comes to publishing.
Yeah, it's publishing Red in Tooth and Claw.
It's ballsy. Well, maybe it's not ballsy because it's been introduced by Bob Sauerberg, who's retiring. What he has said is that it won't be a one-size-fits-all model. The type of paywall that each brand picks up will be driven by consumer demand and engagement. I'm not quite sure what that means, but I guess it means that they don't all have to have four articles a month or four articles a week or whatever it is. And they don't have to have, they can have the paywall around certain sections of content and not have it around other sections of content. So Architect's Digest can have a massive image library that is paywalled, but keep their kind of regular news free and stuff like that. Bon Appetit might have all its recipes behind a paywall, but have I don't know what else Bon Appetit does.
It's just one of the things, like a paywall shouldn't just be a hammer to hit your titles on the head with. It should be something that you carefully consider whether it works for each audience. And the thought of them just shoving this up, and yeah, it's sink or swim with the titles. Well, audiences aren't like that. If you've got a good set of titles, your audience will be different for every single one of them, and this will work for some and not others.
So, but I am going to play devil's avocado on this one.
Nice.
Because if a magazine exists and is sustainable, it's because it has a niche audience to one extent, you know, to whatever big that, however big that niche ends up being, who value that content. And if you get it right, they will pay for that content. Condé Nast, of all companies, you know, there's a few leading global magazine brands that should be able to make paywalls work because they have really, really good titles. So I don't know, maybe they can do it. But it'll be interesting to watch.
I think this...
Okay, one example, Vogue. So most of Vogue's online presence is to drive people to the premium luxury magazine that has got all the advertising. That's sold as, like, you know, a massive monthly issue. People buy it because they want to be seen to have Vogue. So in that sense, a lot of the online presence is almost marketing for the print magazine. And if they shove a paywall up on that, I think they're almost losing their marketing opportunity for the print magazine.
But then you just bundle your print and digital subscription.
I suppose.
Yeah. That's
fair enough.
Yeah.
So that's Mr. Sauerberg, if you're looking for a replacement, I'm right here.
I think it's worth flagging up a couple of responses that we saw to this on Twitter. So former head of strategy at News UK and TO of, I think it's pronounced Agate, Dominic Young, who obviously has a competing...
Not Agate?
Or Agate. Or Agate, one of them. Who obviously
it's
have
got to
a...
be gate. It's a play on gate. Gated content.
Agate. Okay. Well, I don't know why I went all Greek with it. So CEO of Agate, Dominic Young, said, "I don't like paywalls. The word and what it implied. Blocking, locking away, demanding users do things they don't want to. It's awful that the internet has trained us to think and speak about our own products this way because it doesn't work." Now, it kind of...
I mean, when you go into the shop and you hand money over for a magazine, that's kind of how this works.
Yeah, I think he's specifically talking around digital there. And it's true that people aren't habituated to pay online yet, but maybe this is about trying to create the behavior. M. Kuntzer, who's content editor at Content Insights, makes the point that there are some interesting alternatives. She mentions Agate. But she says, "But I feel strongly that we need to stop looking to the NYT as the holy grail of sub-success. Their circumstances are unique and few other publications share them."
I think what's more interesting was what Matt Ingram was saying. Chris, you've been banging on about that for years. What happens when all the good information is behind the paywalls and all the bad information is free and plentiful?
Yeah, he's absolutely right to say that. You're right. This has worried me for a long time because it just feels to me that when all the quality news and all the quality content goes behind paywalls, you're exposing the people who don't have the ability or the, you know, the compunction to pay to kind of the wolves of disinformation. I actually want to argue now, and I think I'm going to write a column about it, that if you can afford to, and if you, you know, support democracy, it's actually incumbent on you to subsidize free access to news to those who can't afford it.
Oof.
Although I can remember asking Alan Hunter this, who's head of digital at the Times last year. You know, I passed your point on to him, and he said, "Well, actually, if you think about it, people have..." Before digital came along, people always paid for newspapers. There was never this, "Oh, what about all the people who can't afford to buy a newspaper? Will you buy one a week or you wouldn't get it every day?" And he also says, you know, in this country, certainly, I don't know about the rest of the world, but we are very lucky to have the BBC, and they will always be, whether you think they're too left or too right, they will always be a, quote, quality source of information.
Just as a couple of responses then to Alan, a belated response, you know, newspapers were not the dominant, you know, they've only been around in their current form for what is it, like a century? And before that, the way people got their news was very different. They didn't necessarily pay for it. And the fact is that the internet has changed how people consider news as a commodity. You know, people will be exposed to predations now that didn't exist before the rise of the internet.
That was a conversation killer.
We did a paywall special last year. So what will we call it?
No. It's not a paywall special. It's access an information. To news special.
As we said the week before last, I love being a journalist, even with all the bad news around it and all the kind of the constant attacks on the press. I think it's one of the most fun roles I've ever had in my life. One of the least fun aspects of it, though, is transcribing. I think both of you would agree that it's not necessarily the part of the job you enjoy the most.
Therefore, it's a void.
So we're very lucky on this podcast to have the partnership with Trint, which has a very clever automated transcription tool which we use for all our interviews. So we just want to give a big thanks to Trint and kind of a recommendation that if you do have another way to get somebody to take all the arduous, you know, transcribing off your plate, go for it. This week, I spoke to Simon Brew, the editor and founder of Film Stories, a podcast-turned-crowdfunded magazine. After a string of successful endeavors, Simon decided to take a leap of faith and dive into the world of independent magazines. So we spoke about what people really mean by the term niche, the do's and don'ts of successful crowdfunding campaigns, and why sometimes it's best to jump into a risky endeavor head first. But I began by asking him about how Film Stories began.
Film Stories actually began life as a podcast last summer. So the infancy of this, the infancy is actually fairly recent, that I was coming out of 10, 11 years of Den of Geek that I'd founded and edited. I was also going through a bereavement and I kind of wanted to just retreat into a room, talk into a microphone about films that I love, record it and just see what it was like putting something like that out. That struck me as, for me, quite a bold thing for me personally to do.
Yeah.
And I put the podcast out, and to my surprise, I always thought, it always sounds weird when people say this, but it is genuine. I mean, to my surprise, people listened and people seemed to like it. And it was very helpful to me throughout a very tough period of my life, that I came back week after week and told stories about films, which is kind of what got me into Den of Geek in the first. That's part of where that idea came from. Mm. And and it was just fun and it was pure. And the story from that point on was just like, well, I thought, well, okay, what do I want to do next? I was at the proverbial career crossroads. I've always loved doing print magazines. And the half joke that I tell is I came up with what would be career and commercial suicide all wrapped up into one package, doing something that's apparently dying. I was just like, well, that sounds perfect. And there was a bit of that to it. And the germ of an idea for a magazine came more and more to the front of my head. I just thought, well, this might be the moment. No, this might be the point where I'll never get a chance to roll that dice again. Mm. And so, I mean, long story short, I rolled the dice. I got a kick. Working with one or two people who just been brilliant. I put a Kickstarter together, but at the point the Kickstarter was running, I'd actually got half of the first issue of what I thought would be a mainstream film magazine I'd really love to read together. Mm. And so, I mean, that was one of the things for me. It's just I back quite a few Kickstarters. I get very frustrated that you wait years and years for something that doesn't, and I wanted
people to... I'm nodding. I've lived through that, you know, the sort of three-year wait for something that may or may not turn up.
It's hard, isn't it? I see both sides of it. It's hard, but I wanted people to have something tangibly in their hand. By the end of the year, I wanted to deliver on that very quickly. Also, a bit of me, I guess, wanted to prove I could do it. And we come to what, January now, and issue two of the magazine as we speak is just going into distribution. Issue three is on my screen in front of me. We've done a reader event. I think I'm up to something like 30, 35 podcasts now. And there's some pretty there's plans for other things now. Some of them are film stories, some of them not film stories, but I'm kind of thinking I'm a bit back against the wall and I'm just going to go for it.
You mentioned then that it was kickstarted, and I wondered, yes, how did you actually approach that in terms of selling it to people who might choose to crowdfund it?
I told the truth.
Yeah?
Yeah, fundamentally at heart, I told the truth, and I put a Kickstarter page up. And yeah, we had some concept design work done, although bits of it changed, bits of it didn't. But I did a very strict, here is what I'm going to do, what we're going to do. Here is when we're going to do it. Here is what it looks like at the moment. If you can support it, that's brilliant. If not, spread the word. If it's not for you, that's fine. And I just told the truth and used social media to promote it. But that was it. I'd like to tell you there's a massive and if I was a highly paid consultant, I probably would tell you that there's a massively complicated way to do it.
Yeah, there's this formula, there's this algorithm to make a successful Kickstarter. Oh, yeah,
and I'll tell you what it is at £2 million an hour if you want. Or fundamentally, just pour your heart and soul out onto a page and tell the truth. And that's what I did. And it may have worked, it may not have worked. I mean, thankfully, it got traction with people. It got traction with some high-profile people as well. But I don't necessarily want to cite them particularly, because the person who's got two Twitter followers who backed it is just as important to me as the person who has directed a major movie. And that's no slight on either of them. I just think we're kind of all in it together.
Yeah, particularly if you're clustering around this, you know, this niche. It doesn't actually matter who, you know, what side of the conversation you're coming at it from.
And also, what I will say is, if the Kickstarter hadn't worked, I would have found a way to do it anyway. Mm. It's just Kickstarter gave the clue's in the name, isn't it, really? It just did give it that kickstart, yeah. Bluntly. And also the fact that it was in their hands, right? And it was in people's hands, I think, 2 weeks after the Kickstarter ended. I was really proud of that.
That is practically unheard of.
I thought that was something.
Yeah.
And I have plans to do more magazines in the future if I can make this independent publishing model work, some of which Kickstarter, some of which not. But I just thought fundamentally that is a principle to aim for. You promise something and you deliver it, and you deliver it as quickly as you can to a standard, obviously, but as quickly as you can.
Yeah. So other than the kind of enthusiasm you had for the subject matter, what was it about this independent publishing model that made you think this is viable, that this could work as a sort of much smaller alternative to kind of the great publishing houses?
I didn't.
Really?
I think I'm really undermining my consultancy career here. It was a risk. Mm. It was a big fundamental, I'm putting my heart on my sleeve, risk. I think there's something to it. I mean, don't get me wrong, I've not waded into this naively. I was aware of the highs and lows and what could go right and what could go wrong. But it was still a massive step into the unknown. Yeah.
So between Film Stories, which, as you said, doesn't necessarily just talk around superhero movies, but around, no. But basically whichever film stories that people want to tell. And, endeavors like Bauer's Pilot TV and some of the stuff they've been doing around kind of 80s TV magazines specifically.
Yeah, I saw that.
Is the term niche even appropriate for these types of products?
Well, Coronation Street viewing is a niche, isn't it? Yeah. It's just a huge niche, it's just another term used to subdivide people's interests in my mind. But I get where you're coming from in terms of niche publishing. We're talking about the below the mainstream, the very segmented interests. I mean, the term is the term. I also think you've got ways to get to small audiences with magazines, websites and books now that just didn't exist, 10, 15 years ago, that an assortment of barriers with very big difficulties associated have come down or become easier to negotiate. So in terms of the word niche, I don't have massive feelings on it, really, and nor did I overthink that. I just believed in something and went for it. Again, and I know it continues to be quite a boring answer, but it is genuinely the truth.
That's nice. It's kind of a very optimistic way of looking at things, I think.
There's not a single PowerPoint presentation I've done for Film Stories.
That's the dream, I think. Holy
there
shit.
There isn't. I guess if there's one thing that I've done consistently throughout my career, it's I've got things done. For better or worse, I've got things done. I've made my mistakes, and I've had things fail, I've had things work, and my mistakes have all been in plain sight, but I've got things done. And I kind of, because I've come from, I've come through small companies or small magazines and the budget end of publishing, it's just like I'm conscious that a lot of the time it's a street fight just to get noticed. And if you say you're going to do something, you do it is absolutely fundamental. I think that's probably the thing that's helped me the most, just making things exist for better or worse. Yes, I edited a magazine called Micromart for 10, 11 years. Mm. One of the things I'm proudest of with that is we must have given 30, 40 people their first paid writing break over that period of time.
Yeah, that's very, that's got to feel great, having given that many people, kind of a leg up in the industry.
I don't quite see it like that. I just see it as, if someone's held the ladder for you, I think morally it's incumbent on you to hold the ladder for someone else. So it wasn't, I wish I could say it was sat here with a, I wanted to swell my heart moment. And of course I did. I wanted to help people. But I was very respectful of the fact that people had given me a chance. I wanted to give that chance to other people. The film and entertainment ecosystem is troubling in a few ways. That we've got some excellent. I mean, I love Empire Magazine. And Empire Magazine what Terry White's doing at Empire Magazine, with a drive to support new writers, is just great. But she's very much an exception to the rule.
Yeah.
I think it's notable what she's doing because not that many people are as overtly doing it, and she bangs the drum really hard.
Yeah, she really does. She's fantastic.
And she's not. not the only one doing it. So there are others out there, but I just think it's really important that she does it. I think that's such a thing.
Yeah.
But I think with the entertainment website ecosystem as well, it's a little secret, and this isn't related specifically to the job I came out of, but there's a little secret that budgets are squeezed and it's tougher and tougher and it's SEO dominated and there's less wiggle room, mm-hmm. really. And also, as a consequence, less opportunities. And we saw a growth in outlets over the last couple of years that just weren't paying people. And I say this as a reformed sinner. I am clear on this. There's a degree of double standards to what I'm saying. Mm. In that the early days of what you know, a project I worked on, it didn't pay people. I think that's fundamentally wrong, and I learned from the lesson, and I've tried to address that since. And so over the last 7-8 years, in particular, when I've been doing things, zero budget is not an option. My fundamental feeling is, if you are publishing writing and that is your business, you budget for writing. The whole "we've got no budget for that, you shouldn't be publishing writing if you've not got a budget for writing." And so I made it part and parcel of film stories that at least two people in every issue would be getting their first paid print work.
Oh, very nice.
And as it's turned out, in the first two issues, we've had 5 in each. I can't promise to stay at that rate, but and they're paid quickly. They're not paid brilliantly, but I'm transparent at the fact that because it's self-funded and Kickstarter, we're paying £30 a page. And I'm telling people who are, I'm having some really strange conversations with writers, and God bless writers who are expressing gratitude for getting the work. And I'm just trying to have a chat with them, just like, no, you need to be a little bit wide open that I'm ripping you off a little bit.
Yeah.
That I am getting the best end of this deal, and that your words are worth more than that. And also, I've been transparent with people that if we grow the sales and money comes in, the rate will go up, because I think, again, that's fundamentally the right thing to do.
Mm. No, that's really good. And I think it chimes with, you know, the most successful smaller properties out there that you see, you know, from everything from, you know, the kind of the indie games publishers to, you know, certain webcomics. You deliver on what you set out to, on what you said you're going to do.
Yes, very much so. And indie video game publishing has been groundbreaking, utterly groundbreaking. Some of the stuff that's coming out on major platforms now is just incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible. And the ingenuity and the growing willingness of an audience who tends to need a lot of things curating to try stuff has been gratifying as well.
We ask all our guests, what is the last piece of media, you know, whether that be film, game, novel, podcast, anything that really affected you emotionally?
This is a very easy question for me, because, and I wrote about it in issue 1 of Film Stories magazine, of which you can still buy back issues. I forgot all this bit, didn't I? Yeah, Film Stories. If I weave it into this, you can't cut that bit out. Is
no,
that right?
Seamless.
Seamless. No one will notice that if you go to filmstories.co.uk, you can subscribe and buy back issues and all that stuff. No, it was the film Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again. And I wrote about it quite a lot in issue 1, that I lost my mum last year, and I found that there'll be people listening to this who've been through it, and so it was horrible. It was horrible, and it had all sorts of effects and impact on my head. And I felt kind of like an unreliable film writer for a while, that I wasn't really getting into films that other people were loving, and I knew they were good, I just couldn't find a way in or something like that. I went to see Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again. I quite like the first one. I'm not much of a film snob, I'm afraid. It's just like, you like what you, unless it's, we're talking like recent Adam Sandler films, I'll get on my high horse as much as you like. But the first one, I just thought, oh, that was a fun throwaway party film. The second one just knocked me out, and I still maintain, non-ironically, it is a really, really, really good film. Mm. But it went to me, here I go, I'm going to go pretentious. Are you ready for my run-up
for
this?
No, do it.
It went to me for kind of what cinema and films can do and media can do, in that I just sat and bawled my eyes out for about 40-50% of that film, because of what it was talking about and the way it talked about it. It's just like, I just thought that was great. There's something massively mainstream, and in the midst of it, they've wrapped in conversations about really difficult things, conversations that I clearly needed to be having at that point. And there it all was. And I do, as on a surface level, love the film, but in terms of a film that's had a massive, any piece of media that's had a massive impact on me, it just knocked me sideways, and still does. I think it's great.
So if this is your first time tuning in, or you've tuned in and you haven't yet signed up to the newsletter, we have a newsletter. As this goes out every Wednesday, and it's got all the news, all the links to all the news and things we've discussed, plus some things we didn't get time to discuss, plus like a kind of mini article on who's been interviewed this week, plus links for what we're writing and loads of other stuff. So yeah, if you want to sign up for that on our website at voices.media, we would very much appreciate it.
That was a lot of pluses.
It's a long newsletter.
And if you would like, you can follow us on Twitter, where we get stuff out every day about the news that's going on in this little space that we love so much. Follow us at Media Voices Pod.
And until next week, when we are going to be back with another absolutely fantastic guest, thank you very much and goodbye.